Hi everyone, this is Sarah from The Journey and welcome to another expert special. Now, here at The Journey, we are very focused not only on physical health and obviously the things that you can do to put yourself in the best position, but also mental health, which we think is inextricably linked. And we also think that the entire journey from conception, pregnancy, postnatal can be really challenging from an emotional standpoint. So today, we're really lucky to be joined by a psychologist, author, a yoga teacher, and lots more, Susie Redding. She's going to be talking to us about the practical way she approaches self-care, something that she feels she learned the hard way, is something that is so crucial and vital to all of us, especially when we're on the path to parenthood. So without further ado, let's hear from Susie. Hi, Susie. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Sarah. It is a great privilege and a pleasure.
Well, likewise. Now, at The Journey, we are very big on the mental health aspect of everything to do with the journey, which is something that, you know, I think is maybe less focused on just because, you know, often when we're going through kind of fertility, conception, pregnancy, having little kids, the kind of first thought is on the kind of medical health side and the physical health side. But, you know, there's an awful lot of the mental health side, especially for those people that come up against obstacles, and even for people that don't, because it's a big life change. So we're really happy to have someone with your expertise on the show. So perhaps as a starting point, you can just tell us a little bit about yourself, what you do, what you're passionate about, and what makes your approach a bit different.
Wonderful. There are things that are leaping out at me already in what you said about how, you know, we're focusing on the physical body and on recovery. And I think what I've learned in my fabulously varied career with lots of different twists and turns, the overarching theme has always been well-being. You know, that's what I've always been working with, but there are lots of different strings to my bow. So I originally trained as a psychologist. So I'm a chartered psychologist. But when I finished my degree, for a whole heap of different reasons, I didn't actually practice as a psychologist. I just moved to the UK. There were bits of my degree that weren't recognized here by the British Psychological Society. I didn't plan on being here for a long time. So I fell back on the part-time job that I had as I was going through university, which was working as a personal trainer. And again, for lots of different reasons, I wound up staying in London for a little longer than I had planned. It turned into 7 years, and I had a thriving personal training business. In that time, I also did yoga teacher training qualifications. So I was working as a personal trainer, a yoga teacher one-on-one, and a health coach. And from that experience, I learned the inseparable nature of mental health and physical health. You know, the fact is we move not just for, you know, muscles and bones, we move for our mental health. So all of those different experiences of working with different people in different ways has informed how I work now. And really, to be honest with you, it's my life experience that set me on this trajectory. So that was motherhood colliding with the terminal illness of my father and going through what I call energetic bankruptcy. And in my own healing recovery, I've learnt the true transformative power of self-care. And that's what I focus on now, empowering people with the tools of self-care and helping them cope, helping them heal, and then helping prepare for what's next, because life is inherently stressful, isn't it?
Yeah, there's always something around the corner that you didn't anticipate. Now, you're also an author, and yeah, you've written several books on this subject. Can you talk to us a little bit about the subject matters of the books you've written?
Sure. So the first book I wrote was called The Self-Care Revolution, and I wrote that when I had my little boy. That was my way of making a contribution on the career front while being present for him. And in that, I wanted to put together a framework of self-care, something that it's a diagram that helps people connect with something nourishing in the moment. Because in my experience, when we need it the most, that's when it's really hard to put your finger on something accessible and resonant. So in the self-care revolution, it was presenting that framework. It was talking about, defining self-care, why we need it, and then most importantly, how to do it. And then the second book was, it's called Stand Tall Like a Mountain. I wanted to take a look at how we could make self-care more accessible to parents. Because I think, who needs self-care more than parents? But at that time, we are so time poor, we're energy squeezed, we feel guilty taking time for ourselves. We need a whole new toolkit, because quite often the things that we used to do to nourish ourselves become inaccessible to us in our experience as parents. So Stand Tall Like a Mountain is very much about empowering parents, but also taking a look at how we can teach our children these same skills and broadening out how it is that we can support our children through big emotions and challenging life experiences. And then my third book, the little book of self-care, is 30 new practices. And it's just a little book that you can give to someone that's having a tough time. You can keep it in your back pocket, and it's like self-care on the go. So there's something for everyone in there.
Well, I love this. And I think one of the things that we're most passionate about here at The Journey is to not just talk about the mental health aspect, but to actually give practical tools to really help people no matter what they're going through. And I think that's obviously exactly what you're doing. Now, as we discussed, when you're going through the kind of journey right from the very beginning, because I guess of the significance of what you're doing and the inherent kind of lack of control we have over this whole process, I have found that it's been a great source of anxiety to so many people. And as I said, that's even aside from having kind of traumatic issues like miscarriage or infertility and that kind of thing. But perhaps you can, give us some of the tools for your book, from your books and your kind of theories for dealing with a few of those stages. So perhaps let's take people who are either, getting concerned about their fertility, who are struggling with infertility, and who are really kind of having a hard time. Is there anything that you can think of from your toolkit that might be useful for people who are going through that phase in their lives to kind of hang on to? Because I do think self-care is a very important aspect of that.
Absolutely. What sort of leaps out at me first would be specific coping tools, and then also looking at the skill of relaxation. So should we start with coping skills?
Yeah.
I think we're all aware of mindfulness. I think it is really, it's the mother of all coping skills. So mindfulness it gives us the ability to step back and to be less pushed about by our thoughts and feelings. We still have thoughts, all of those thoughts and feelings, but we feel less swept away by them. So I think that would be first and foremost where I would start in developing the skill of mindfulness. Mindfulness on its own is not enough, though, and especially when you are facing stressful times, tough times, in times of grief and loss. Mindfulness is not enough. In those circumstances, it can be a bit clinical. Yeah, we're bearing witness to all of this stuff that's happening, and it can be, enormous pain. So it needs to be tethered with the skill of compassion. It's essential. There has to be tenderness. There has to be that kind voice of the inner elder saying, yes, I'm experiencing this. And oh my goodness, of course I feel like this. It won't be like this forever. And really extending such a generous helping of tenderness and gentleness towards ourselves. I think that's what helps us cope. Another coping skill is to keep your mind focused on what lies within your control, because so often we get absorbed by things that we just don't have any influence over. And if it's beyond your sphere of influence, no worry, no effort, no thought, no action is going to make any difference. So in terms of mindful use of your energy and your time and your effort, direct it towards what you can do something about. So we can't make our bodies conceive. We cannot guarantee what's going to happen in pregnancy and in giving birth and what happens next. All we can do is pave the way for what it is that we would like to see happen. So that's the stuff that lies within your control. How you're talking to yourself, how you're feeding yourself, hydration, you know, how you are, you know, prioritizing sleep and restorative practices. That's the stuff that lies within your control.
Yeah. That's all amazing advice, actually. And I think it's something that we really need to be a bit more conscious of, especially as you say, the kind of being kind and compassionate. But I think sometimes, you know, things like mindfulness or being compassionate towards ourselves doesn't really come easy. Do you have tips? I really struggle with it. So
yes, this is hard to do. You're absolutely spot on. It's so important that we say out loud that this is hard. This is challenging. And if you're coming to these skills when you are feeling squeezed by life, know that this is tough, right? These skills are best learnt in moments of minor irritation first, yes? We build the muscles, so to speak. But, you know, if we find ourselves in these periods of chaos, and that's where I found myself, you know, literally flat on my back, it was like, how can I rebuild myself? And I think that maybe that takes us on to the second strategy, which is looking at restorative healing practices. How can we connect with our bodies? How can we develop our self-soothing capacity? I think we have to acknowledge that we live in a society that vastly underestimates sleep and relaxation. You know, FOMO is real. You snooze, you lose. And all of these people that can quote that Richard Branson only needs 4 hours of sleep at night to function, you know, it's just, we've got to understand the value of sleep, rest, and relaxation. And in the absence of those things, because let's be honest, there are times when you can be making all the healthy choices that promote good sleep and still not get it. It's impossible to get it. So in those times, we need to prioritize rest. And when there isn't time to rest, because we're all, you know, pulling our hair out, aren't we, saying, when do we get to do that? Then you work with your breath. Yes, because sleep, rest, relaxation, and breathing all stimulate your parasympathetic nervous system. Rest and digest. So in the absence of good sleep or time to rest, then please work with your breath. You're doing it anyway. It doesn't take any extra time, right? But the way that you breathe has a profound effect on how you feel and on the state of your nervous system.
And do you have any specific breathing techniques, or is it a case of kind of finding out what's right for the individual?
I have loads of different breathing techniques, and you're spot on. It's very much what works for you as an individual. However, there are some broad themes. So basically, when it comes to the breath, we want our breath to be as relaxed and as spacious as possible. Yeah, when our breathing gets tight and short, that's when we're far more likely to feel the stress response, you know, cascade. Yes, so smooth, relaxed breath, that's what we're after. But for a lot of people, if they're already in a heightened state of anxiety, if someone says to you, if you're feeling anxious, hey, take a few deep breaths, yeah, sometimes that can actually make you feel more agitated. Mm-hmm. So I think the simplest way in, and often the most effective way in, is to, instead of thinking about the breath, move with the breath. And this is where yoga is very powerful. So I think most people are aware of the, you know, the sun salute, the very first movement from standing tall with your arms down by your sides, looking forwards. The first movement is breathe in, sweep your arms out and up overhead, hands touching above your head, look up to your hands. Now, if you were just to repeat that one movement, so breathing in, arms up, breathing out, arms down, yeah, what this is doing is it gives you an opportunity to focus just on the movement, yes? So instead of focusing on your breath, you're focusing on the movement. Now, this is so powerful because research has shown that standing with a tall, upright spine and an open-hearted chest taps you into a feeling of personal power. It increases your subjective mood, your subjective energy levels. Yeah, it helps us feel more present and capable. And it's also helping you breathe better. And when you breathe better, you feel better. So if you to do just six mountain breaths, that's enough to create a shift. Yeah.
But you know, it's funny, while you were just saying that, I just tried it and you're absolutely right. It's brilliant. I think that's but I really love that. It's kind of giving people, like, no matter how practiced you are or not, because a lot of us come into this and we seek help for these kind of things when we're in crisis. And sometimes just having the simplest kind of starting point can be really powerful. Now, obviously, as well, you have talked about what happens when we make this transition from, you know, being a kind of single person into actually being responsible for another person and being a parent. And obviously the kind of dynamic shift is wonderful in many ways, but it's also, you know, especially in the first kind of few months and year or so, it can be a complete vortex actually. And a lot of us struggle, but then again, as you say, a lot of us really struggle with finding any time whatsoever. And as you also said, it's really hard to get that restorative sleep when you're feeding and you're up a lot. And it's really, really hard in those early days. And sometimes I feel like people don't kind of talk about it enough. But I guess from your own experience, when you first had your kids, what did you find were the kind of best things to do? And I guess what are some of the highlights from your book that kind of new parents who are maybe struggling a little bit, what should they be thinking about?
Okay, I want to preface this with everything I've learned the hard way, right? I've made some sensational mistakes that have led to some really useful learning. So when I first, when Charlotte was first born, I wanted to give every cell and fiber of my being to her. Yeah, I wanted to give her everything I had. And I found myself totally negating my needs. Now, I think to a certain extent, when we become parents, we have to negate our needs to a certain extent, yes? If they wake at night, we can't just roll over and say, not now, doesn't suit me. You know, you have to leap into action. But we shouldn't completely subjugate our needs. And I found myself, you know, I was exhausted by the end of the day. And I'd think to myself, I just want to get my head down on the pillow. I'm not going to eat dinner tonight because I'm so desperate to sleep. And then, of course, this sets a downward spiral into action so that the next morning I wake, I'm hangry. It leads to a poor nutritional choice. I didn't have the energy to exercise. I found myself, when Charlotte did have these tiny little naps during the day, I would watch Bold and the Beautiful or Days of Our Lives. And I promise you, if you're not depressed before you watch that stuff, you will be afterwards.
So funny.
I just learned the hard way. And, you know, I was so lucky. I was seeing a postnatal depression counselor. And honestly, I don't know if it was PND or whether it was just grief or exhaustion. But the fact is, she posed this really useful question to me. And she said, what's your self-care like? And I thought, wow, it's not very good right now. And I know about this stuff. But like I said before, the things that I used to do to take care of myself, I couldn't do anymore. But it was a matter of how could I reclaim those things in a totally different shape? How could I meet my needs where I am at now? So I turned off the telly. I made a mindful use of my downtime. Even if it was just 5 minutes, I'd roll out my mat. And what I did for months on my yoga mat was sleep. And for as long as Charlotte slept, that's as long as I lay there. And I did beautiful restorative yoga practices that just rebuilt my energy bank. So I had something to play with again. And just like that downward spiral of one poor choice leads to another, the beautiful thing is that one good choice sets the upward spiral into motion so that I was moving again. And from that, the benefits of the, you know, the mental health benefits of exercise, then it was easier to make a better nutritional choice. And then it was easier. I was, you know, promoting better sleep. And that's how we heal. That's how we restore. I call it one micro moment at a time. Yeah.
I think that's a really, really good point, is that sometimes, you know, it can just feel so overwhelming and we're like, oh, we've got to kind of do this, that and the other. But actually, as you say, there can be a virtuous circle from just making one very small change. Now, obviously, this postnatal depression counselor asked you a really pertinent question, but I'm guessing, you know, the answer is going to be different for every person. and what is, you know, restorative and self-care for one person might not be for another. So how would you recommend that somebody think about this? Because obviously, you know, we can sit here and say do X, Y, and Z, but actually it's really an individual thing. So when you are a parent, you're feeling kind of at the depths, how would you even start to approach, you know, what might be good for you to add and do, and what might be the kind of first positive micro step?
Honestly, I could talk on this for such a long time. There are so many different things that we can do, and you're absolutely right. Different things resonate for different people, so it's not a one-size-fits-all approach. And I would also say that your needs as an individual change massively over time as well. So that's why we need a really broad toolkit from which to draw. And that's what makes this stuff confusing, because what one person finds nourishing might be a total turnoff for somebody else. So that's why self-care as a concept is confusing. But then if you think about it from the point of view that your needs are constantly changing, your preferences are constantly changing, that's why this stuff is an art form, because it really requires us to get quiet, to tune in, to connect, and acknowledge where we're at right now. That in itself is a challenge. And then the next step is acknowledging, hey, this is the thing that I need to help me feel a certain way. So that's why this stuff is so hard. And I want people to just take the pressure off themselves and understand that this is a skill that we learn, and we need a really broad toolkit from which to draw. And that's what I have literally spent the last decade fine tuning. So I've got lots of different options for people to try. For people that are feeling frazzled and exhausted, it can be as simple. Can we try something? Can we try something, Sarah? Have you got your hands free?
Yes.
Okay. So if you make a gentle fist for me, now the soft part of your hand at the base of your thumb, you're going to press that part of your hand into your forehead. Like, imagine you are pressing on two little goatee horns, yeah, with both hands. Gently press your hands against your forehead and just notice how that feels. And hope everyone at home is trying this. If you've only got one hand free, you can just press the back of your hand to your forehead. Okay, just notice and then let that go. Now, what I'm hoping you will have experienced is that gentle pressure against your forehead, it softens the muscles between your eyebrows. It relaxes your eyes. It releases your jaw. It softens the tongue in your mouth, and it slows your rate of respiration down. And it is literally like hitting the reboot button for your nervous system. So this is something so simple that you can just dot through your day. Or it could be using scent, you know, after a nappy change, tenderly, lovingly apply a scented hand balm with the intention of just taking a moment to care for yourself as well as caring for your infant. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's such a good point. You know, it doesn't need to be these huge things that take like an hour out of our day. It can be these, as you say, these kind of micro changes, and I guess just being conscious of it. And I do think that you hit upon something really pertinent. You mentioned it a couple of times about this kind of guilt factor that so many of us feel. Like if we're not doing, it's like you said with your daughter Charlotte, you want to give kind of absolutely everything to your child, especially in the very earliest days. And whilst we do need to do that a lot of the time, I personally find that when I am doing something for myself, I still really struggle with, you know, feeling guilty about, you know, taking that time for myself. Is there any way that, you know, mum guilt is, or dad guilt as well, is like such a real thing. Is there anything that you would say about that and how we deal with that aspect of it?
Yeah, absolutely. And to be honest with you, this is why I'm doing what I'm doing, right? What I learned the hard way was that if I don't nourish myself, how can I be there for those in my care? And if I can't do it for me, I have to do it for my little ones. Yeah. Self-care is the thing that allows us to keep giving and keep going. Our children need us to do it, but yeah. It's bigger than that. Like as a human being, you deserve to be well nourished This is not just in relationship with others, but when we get clear on what self-care is, and that is self-care is healthcare. It's nurturing your mental health, physical health, energetic health, yeah, emotional health. It's the thing that helps you cope in the moment. It's the thing that allows you to heal and restore. It's the thing that then gives you the protective buffer against what happens next. And if you think about who you are as a human being when you are well nourished, self-care is the stuff that gives us access to our best self. And when it comes to parents, we all want to raise healthy, compassionate, resilient children. Well, they need their own self-care toolkit, and they learn by watching us. They learn by what we model and by what we, you know, what comes out of our mouths and the tools that we share with them. So this is where family self-care is really important, and teaching children their own bespoke toolkit of things that are appropriate for their ages and their interests.
Well, this leads me on exactly to my next question. You know, in our kind of modern environment, I don't know if it's like more stressful than, you know, periods of time in the past, but it's a different type of stress. It seems to be this kind of chronic, always kind of on, like always having to compare yourself to someone else, and everything's always has this kind of appearance of perfection, and we all feel so much pressure from it. And I can't help but think that, you know, some of our kids are probably the most stressed out at such a young age. And I do think that what is on a lot of people's minds is how, from the very, very earliest days, do you start to set the scene for, you know, a child learning about this? And I mean, people listening will be at all different kinds of stages, from being pregnant or trying to think about fertility to having a very small person or even having older kids. So, you know, thinking about it right from the kind of earliest days, how do you approach this, given all your experience and what you've learned?
Sure. I think it's important that parents understand you're already doing this stuff. This is not new. This is just broadening it a little further, right? We're already teaching our kids how to brush their teeth and safely cross roads and what constitutes healthy eating. This is now just looking at their toolkit and making sure that we are empowering them with the means to navigate big emotions and challenging life experiences. And from the outset, I want to say that this has not been modeled for most of us growing up. This is relatively new information and new tools. So we've got to throw ourselves a bone here. But I think it also provides us with such a beautiful opportunity to be beginners together and to actually learn this stuff together. Yeah. So we can take the pressure away and let's learn and grow together. That's the mantra, learn and grow together. So where to start with your kids? I think teaching them a framework is really useful. That's why the Vitality Wheel is in each of my books. So it's just helping children understand that, yes, there's nutrition, there's movement, there's being in nature, there's social connection, but there are also mood boosting activities and skills. And there's ways of harnessing your mind that will help you navigate your day. So it's broadening out how it is that we can take care of ourselves, and then specific tools.
So obviously that is kind of better for a slightly older child, but maybe we can come back to what you were saying just a few moments ago about how we as parents really kind of set the scene. So do you think that that means, therefore, that even in the kind of very earliest days when our babies are super, super young, this is something that is really useful to practice, not only for ourselves, but actually to kind of set a really consistent example for our kids to learn that this is important?
Absolutely. I would argue that, yes, the toolkits that I'm talking about, now that's more appropriate for children of like age 3+. But these are skills that we imbue our life with. And you are doing this with your cherubim arms, you know, the moment they're born. This is, you know, when you take your baby outside and you point out the moving cloudscape, or you point out, look at that bird. You are teaching your child appreciation, savoring, gratitude. The tone of your voice is teaching your child kindness, compassion, right? So from the get-go, we are showing our children how it is that we can nurture ourselves and nurture each other.
And I think you also hit the nail on the head as well when you said that this is something relatively new, because and this definitely wasn't done for our generation, for example, because it is something that has become talked about a lot more openly. And I think people have become a lot more conscious of mental health. And that's so fantastic. But as you say, it's, I think we're kind of, we're in a new paradigm where we are now a lot more conscious about nurturing our children's mental health and giving them the kind of toolkit to deal with things. Because I guess the point is, and coming back to your point about, you know, learning what we can control and what we can't, the reality is we all want to kind of put our kids in cotton wool and make them be okay, but life is always going to throw them lots of different curveballs, as it does for all of us. And I guess it is then about equipping them with the skills and the toolkit, as you say, to weather those ups and downs. Would you say that's right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, it's our job to keep our children safe, but we don't want to disempower our children by fixing everything or doing everything for them. And we cannot protect our children from the harsh realities of life, in that we all incur stress and loss, and we're all having to navigate change. These things are hard, but whether you are 4 or 40, they're a normal part of life. And if we try and eradicate those things for our children, we're doing them a great disservice.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's about how can we have an open, honest dialogue about our emotions? How can we share with our children, you know, the things that we're facing in our day? And we talk about these things and we come together as a family and build our toolkit together.
And you talk obviously about being a little bit more conscious about doing this when a child is kind of above 3, because obviously there's a lot more kind of a lot more verbal stuff that can go on between a parent and a child who's over 3. So how would you like really start to approach this? So you mentioned the vitality wheel. So is mm-hmm. this something that you would sit down with a child and you'd explain? Like, example that someone's like listening to this and they've got a very young child and they think, right, I'd really like to give this a go.
If you just come back through my
A good way of doing it.
Yes. If you scroll back through my feed, you'll see a poster that I made with my two little ones with the vitality wheel. Now, I've changed the language. So in Self-Care Revolution, the spokes of the wheel, there's movement and nutrition. Now, I wouldn't use that for a three-year-old. For a three-year-old, it's eat and move. Now, you can use it for under 3. It's eat and move. It's just making sure it's really accessible. So on that first poster, I didn't have any words, because at the time Ted was pre-literate, so it was images. But they use that poster on the wall whenever they're feeling a bit low, a bit bored. It's like, go check out the wheel. What can you do that will help you feel better in this moment? That's one approach.
Great.
Yeah. And it's a useful approach, because it gives your kids choice, and there's always choice. Yeah. It's about empowering. Now there's another approach that I like to use. As your children get older, this is more useful. Where we actually look at what's happening in their day and we talk about what can you do to help you navigate that, and we write it down so that they're building their own resource library of things that will help them navigate stuff that happens on a daily basis, like what to do when I feel sad. When I can't get to sleep, I can try X, Y, and Z. Or if something's happening to me at school with friends that I'm uncomfortable with, these are the things that I can try. So we can actually get very specific. And what amazes me is how incredibly innovative and creative our children are. So it's not like you are spoon-feeding them with solutions. You are co-creating these toolkits together.
Oh, I love that. That's such a great idea, because I mean, I don't think anybody really loves being told what to do. I think it's so much better and so much more impactful when these are things we do together. And I suppose, as you said right from the beginning, this is, you know, we're all beginners together on this front. Now, there's an awful lot of talk, obviously, about, you know, mindfulness and it being a practice. And I mean, I'm really open with the fact that I have struggled in the past with it. I guess I would only say that I've become a little bit better at it, although you should probably not use the term bad or good, but I've become more practiced at it more recently. But at what point do you think that it's appropriate to start talking to children about that and setting them up on that path? And how do you really approach that kind of a thing with a small child?
Oh, do you know what? They're so open to it, and they're learning it from nursery on. You know, sometimes they're more adept at it than we are.
I'm
so
sure
we can learn from them. And that's the thing: if you watch a child in play, they are engaged in deep mindfulness. So I think as parents, we can draw their attention to where they're already doing it, and show them that there are other situations in which they can apply that same skill. Now, for people that feel like mindfulness isn't for them, what I would say is that what's most likely is they haven't come across a mindfulness practice that works for them yet. Yeah, there are lots of different ways in. How do we share it with our kids? I think different things will resonate for different kids, obviously, but they tend to enjoy movement. So I think yoga poses are a fantastic way of building the mindfulness muscle. And this is where you draw their attention to, you know, if you get into a warrior pose. Now, for kids, I call that surfer pose. And you're feeling the strength of your legs, and you're noticing that inner chatter, and you're noticing when the mind darts elsewhere. This is where we just start to bring children's awareness to how the mind works and the fact that they can direct their attention. Yeah, there is a choice as to the thoughts that you cultivate, that you indulge. And one of the practices that this is a really beautiful way of helping children choose to choose happier thoughts, and it's called the mind garden. Now, this is something that's in my book Stand Tall Like a Mountain. Can I share it with you, Sarah? The mind
please.
Garden.
Please, I'm dying to hear it. Please
okay.
Do.
This one is particularly useful for bedtime. So if your cherub is finding it hard to get to sleep, teach them the mind garden. So in your mind, you have a beautiful garden. And that garden is created by your thoughts. Now, there is a time and a place for every single thought. Every thought is okay. Every thought is planting a seed in your garden. And it's your job to then nurture the seeds that you like. And you do that by directing the sunlight and pouring water from your watering can onto that particular seed. So the thoughts that you're enjoying, they create beautiful blooms, and that's where you focus your attention. The thoughts that you don't like so much, the thoughts that aren't helpful, they create a weed. Now, every garden has weeds, and it's okay. It's not about stamping out the weeds, but just don't send all your love and attention to that weed to make it flourish. Bring your attention back to the thoughts that plant the seeds for the flowers that you love.
I think that's great. I don't know about using that for my son. I think I'll use that for me, actually.
Yeah.
Brilliant. That's such a nice way of thinking about it. And I think especially for a young child who maybe is going through anxiety or fearful, and which always seems to come out worse at night, I think that's, you know, such a lovely way of doing it. There are obviously so many tools. And as you said, and I think you're completely spot on about one thing working for another person and another working for another. I mean, the point about mindfulness is that point was made exactly to me when I was really struggling with it. And one of the expert advisors on my board, basically the only person to ever get me to do mindfulness, had actually said exactly the same thing and encouraged me to try out different ways. And finally, I kind of found a way that it worked for me. Now, talking about different ways as well and incorporating, you know, these yoga poses, which I think is a really, really good idea, and trying that out, because I guess, as you say, we just have to try these things out. Mm-hmm. If you were a parent and, you know, sometimes it's difficult to kind of find the time or the resources or a kind of baby yoga class near you, how's a kind of, are there any kind of things on YouTube, or where would you kind of like more about this, and or would you literally just kind of make it up on the spot type of thing?
The thing is, if you have any knowledge of yoga yourself, you can share that with your kids. Yeah. There is sort of like a broad rule of thumb kind of thing. In terms of using your body, it's really, really important that parents know, that people know, that different shapes have different energetic effects. And you've got to think about carefully what you're trying to achieve, right? So when it comes to yoga or any movement, if you were to do standing up stuff, like tree poses, like warrior poses, or even having a dance, now these things are very stimulating and uplifting. So that's useful. If your kids are saying to you, I'm bored, have a little kitchen karaoke session. If they're feeling tired, but they've got to kind of crack on, like you could do a warrior pose or lion breath to blow the cobwebs out. Do not do those things before bedtime, because
yeah.
your children will be wired.
Yeah.
So if you're looking at paving the way for rest and relaxation and sleep, you want to be doing things on the floor. You want to be doing all fours stuff, like cat and dog pose, downward dog pose, or lying down. Child's pose is another one, pigeon pose on all fours, or lying down stuff like twists and knee hugs and things like that. So we do need to be careful. Different movement has different properties, different energetic effects. But if you've been to any yoga class, you can do the same things with your kids. And the amazing thing is that they will let you know what feels good to them. They're not going to do anything that will harm them. Adults are a bit different. You know, we push ourselves. We see someone else doing something and we think, oh, I'll do it just like that. Even if our knees are saying, oh, don't. Your children won't do that. So you're totally safe to explore and play with your kids. And you'll also find there are so many yoga poses dotted through Stand Tall Like a Mountain, Self-Care Revolution, any of those things you can share with your kids. Just bear in mind what kind of energetic effect that you are setting out to achieve.
Yeah, because no one wants a hyper child just before bed, that's for sure.
No.
Well, that's so useful because there's so many practical things in there. Now, I guess final question would be, you know, you said at the outset of this that you'd kind of like discovered all of these things, you know, the hard way and through going through lots of things yourself. Now, I guess looking back now with everything you know, what would be like the one bit of advice you'd go back and tell your kind of self at that point, do you think?
Oh, it would be nourish you, take care of you, be tender, be kind. And none of that stuff has to take huge chunks of time, or none of it has to be expensive. None of it even has to require any energy. There are always the means to tenderly nourish your health. And beautiful things come from that place of nourishment. It really is the gift that keeps on giving. So I would hope that that would be the message that people take, that please nourish you. Please, please, please nourish you.
Well, thank you so much. There's so much useful stuff. And what we'll do is we'll put up on the show notes the links to your book and also the picture of the Vitality Wheel, which I think is going to be really, really useful. And then also links to you directly. So if people want any more information, they can give you a shout on Instagram and things like that. But Susie, thank you so much. I mean, I think what you're saying is so important. And I think it's something we all need to be really conscious of, no matter what we're going through. So I really appreciate you taking the time and sharing this with us.
Thank you, Sarah. Thanks for the opportunity. And I hope it makes a difference.